This is Dr. Michael Brickey with Ageless Lifestyles Radio, cutting-edge thinking for being youthful at every age. On each program, I interview experts on what it takes to live longer, healthier, and happier. Our program takes a holistic approach in addressing anti-aging psychology, medicine, alternative medicine, fitness, nutrition, and wellness. Our emphasis is on innovative thinking and practices that have solid data and results. Second to the common cold, back pain is the most common reason for sick leave at work. Hardly anybody over 50 hasn't had at least one serious episode of back pain or neck pain. I bet you've experienced some yourself. We go to our doctors and we want instant results. Translation, we want pills. We want a quick fix. But painkillers, muscle relaxants, and steroids are likely to aggravate the problem and give the unwanted bonuses of depression, slower healing, and drug dependency. Spine doctor, Dr. Mark Brown, says if you throw away the pills and walk it off, 90% of the time you'll recover from the problem. In fact, you're likely to recover more quickly without the pills. Dr. Brown is an eminent orthopedic spine surgeon. He's on the editorial board of four medical journals and is a professor at the University of Miami. He's both an MD and a PhD. He teaches, does research, and has a clinical practice. I think we'll have to have you back on time management as well. His new book, Conquer Back and Neck Pain, Walk It Off, helps diagnose what kind of pain you have and to determine what to do or what not to do about it. Dr. Brown, many of our listeners have some familiarity with evidence-based medicine from our interview with More Harm Than Good author Dr. Mark Zelikoff. Could you recap for us what evidence-based medicine is?
Yes, Dr. Brickey. Evidence-based medicine is the way that doctors determine what really works and what is safe. The best evidence comes from comparing a treatment to a control. For example, for back pain, a study was performed where one day of bed rest was compared to 7 days of bed rest, and they found that patients that stayed in bed only one day actually got better faster and suffered less than those that stayed in bed for a week with an acute attack of back pain.
Boy, I bet the managed care companies love that research. So get them out and get them moving quickly.
Yes, and it's true that most treatments that really work are actually cost-effective.
Wonderful. I gather the most common cause of back problems and neck problems is disc problems?
The reason why back pain and neck pain are so common in humans is it's genetic, and it's related to degenerative disc disease, which means the disc loses its cushioning power, and that's genetically related. It also occurs in man's best friend, our dogs. It doesn't occur in cats.
Well, the cat lovers will love that. So it's almost like General Motors did planned obsolescence on our discs, and they wear out more quickly than the other body parts?
That's right.
So what does evidence-based medicine say besides get out of bed and get moving?
The best study that has been done for back pain has just been published in the Journal of American Medical Association and New England Journal of Medicine. It came out of Dartmouth Hitchcock Hospital and was actually a study in 17 medical centers and comprised over 4,000 people who had either herniated discs or spinal stenosis, and they were randomized to surgery versus no surgery. The people that had surgery for herniated discs seemed to do a little bit better in the first year than those that did not have surgery, but after a period of 4 years, there's little difference.
And as a surgeon yourself, you often, or typically, discourage people from having surgery.
I actually discourage people from having too much of any type of treatment, be it surgery or steroid injections or painkillers or manipulation. It seems that people that have too much treatment actually prolong the problem.
Let's look at some of the treatments one at a time. What's the problem with muscle relaxants?
Muscle relaxants actually make you drowsy and sedate you. They cause dependency, and the most difficult problem is that after a period of time, if you try to stop taking them, they can be dangerous to withdraw from them. I don't prescribe them at all for back pain patients.
And I believe you said they also contribute to depression?
Yes, they do, just like opioids or narcotics. People that have depression to begin with seem to suffer more from pain syndromes, and the people who develop depression as a result of their infirmity from an attack of back pain, and particularly chronic back pain, also have more difficulty. It becomes a vicious cycle. Taking particularly opioids or narcotics and muscle relaxants compound depression. So first thing we try to do is stop that cycle by weaning people off of those medications.
With the painkillers, by producing the endorphins artificially, it's depressing your body's ability to produce the endorphins naturally. And then, especially when you go off them, your body is very deficient in producing the endorphins. Is that the way it works?
That seems to be the way it works. Actually, the narcotics actually block the body's own painkillers, the endorphins, at the level of the brain and make them ineffective and stop the production of them.
I imagine you have had just hundreds, even thousands of people come to you and they've got a bag full of pills. They say they've tried everything, traction, epidurals. They're at wit's end. They look wrung out and depressed. They want you to come up with a magic bullet and you tell them, throw away your pills. How do you pull that off and convince them to do it?
Well, I take each thing that they're doing. For example, if they're taking a large amount of anti-inflammatory medication, I tell them that the risk of having a bleeding stomach ulcer and dying from that is there and real, and that's a high price to pay for a chronic benign back pain. So I try to stop that. Smoking is a big issue. Smoking causes the people to become sedentary and not exercise, and also actually poisons the discs, makes them more degenerated and painful, and causes osteoporosis and soft bones and so on. And I go through the whole litany of horrors that smoking causes and try to get them to stop smoking.
Gee, it almost sounds like reefer madness or all those scare movies we see, drunk driving movies. How many people heed your advice the first time and get rid of the pills or even stop smoking?
It's amazing if you take the time, and I find that patients often tell me, you're the first doctor that really spent the time to tell me why. And if you do that as a physician, it's amazing how many people comply. Frequently, I'll see a former patient at dinner, and they'll come up to me and tell my wife, your husband saved my life. And she said, oh, when did he operate on you? And they say, no, he didn't operate. He got me to quit smoking and exercise.
You see exercise as the magic bullet. Let's start with how exercise affects cell nutrition for the discs.
The discs don't have any blood supply and depend upon a pumping action of muscle action to bring the nutrition into the cells within the disc. Our bodies were made to exercise. Very important that we get at least a half an hour of aerobic exercise a day for our bones and for our discs and for our muscles and our heart. There are three forms of exercise: aerobic exercise, such as walking, swimming, stationary bicycle, treadmill, strength training, and agility or flexibility. The latter two are not as important.
Not as important for recovering from the back pain, but still very important. And I would even add for people over 60, making sure that they get some balance exercise as well.
Very important. Very important, Dr. Bricky. I should have you on my team.
Oh, I'd love to. Now, as a second reason that exercise is so valuable is that it enhances the repair of the damage. Could you tell us more about that?
Yes, particularly with a herniated disc. When the disc slips out from between the vertebrae, the tissue in the disc doesn't have the nutrition, the pumping action, and the body tends to produce enzymes that actually breaks down the disc tissue, and those products of the disc tissue need to be resorbed. And exercise tends to make that happen sooner, so that we find now that rather than having people with a herniated disc go to bed, we have them get up and walk as much as they can within the limits of the pain and stamina.
And then the third function is endorphins, so it's not just runner's high that's producing the endorphins, but even a moderate amount of exercise?
Moderate amount of exercise. Walking 30 to 60 minutes a day increases your endorphins, your stamina, your balance. Thank you for reminding me. And the strength of your discs, no question about it.
And the endorphins are going to do the same thing that the narcotic painkillers would do.
That's exactly right.
One of the things that surprised me was you didn't seem to favor massage as a treatment. Did I read that right?
Yes. I found that deep pressure massage feels good at the time, like all touch therapy, because it fools the brain. Brain allows you to feel the perception of massage rather than a deep ache from your back. But it irritates the small facet joints at each level of your disc spaces. And a day or two later, you'll develop pain from those irritated facet joints and not realize that it came from the deep massage.
I would have thought that muscles get real tense, and if you could relax the muscles, that would help. But the damage more than offsets the muscle relaxing?
I think so. And again, for an acute episode of neck or back pain, muscle fatigue, from a long time in front of the computer, a mild massage is certainly indicated and will help. But repeated massages and manipulations, for that matter, seem to aggravate the situation more, as like other types of treatment that are prescribed for too long, they tend to aggravate the situation.
For somebody who doesn't have back problems, is massage a good idea just to help people relax?
I don't see any problem with massage as long as the massage person is not doing heavy, deep massage sort of prophylactically to try to prevent problems where it actually bruise the muscle or bruise the facet joint.
You've done some chiropractic treatment yourself, and you have very clear guidelines on when you think it is helpful and when it can do some harm. What's your take on chiropractic medicine?
There's some evidence-based medicine that in acute episodes of back pain, and particularly in the initial episodes in younger people, healthier people, that it actually shortens the course of an acute episode. There's probably a good underlying anatomical and physiological basis for that. And most chiropractors are well-trained and good primary care physicians for determining who should be manipulated and who should not be manipulated. Where I see the problem with chiropractic, as I do with all the other types of treatment, surgery, and medication, is when it's overused. And I'll frequently see people who are relieved of their acute episode of low back pain, and then maintenance treatments and preventive manipulations are prescribed to prevent chest or neck pain, and then they develop a generalized aching pain throughout their spine, and it's because they're getting preventive manipulations on a tri-weekly or weekly basis over a number of months, and all I do is stop it, and then the pain goes away.
So we're getting a common theme of over-treatment in a lot of cases.
Exactly.
Now, you also had concerns about people over 60 getting chiropractic treatment.
Over the age of 60, most patients with neck and back pain have progressive degenerative disc disease, and they begin to form bone spurs and osteophytes, which are just the natural healing process of the body. And manipulation in the neck, for example, in a patient with these narrowed and bulging discs can further compress the nerves or even the spinal cord and cause nerve damage or paralysis. I've actually seen a patient who had a manipulation in the neck and a bone spur clamped off an artery to the brain and caused a stroke.
Mm.
Also, patients that are over the age of 60 are more prone to having soft bones or osteoporosis, and they can be susceptible to fracture with a manipulation. So I usually keep it under the age of 60.
It seems like every few months we see a new piece of traction equipment. Does any of it help?
I'm not big on traction. There's a few things that I put into the quack medicine category, and one is inversion traction boots. I see people that come in who I'm convinced that they were hanging upside down in traction and ruptured their discs. They started out with a simple back pain that turned out to be a catastrophe.
Oh, but it looks so good in the movie American Gigolo when Richard Gere's hanging upside down lifting weights.
He was younger then.
Clearly. I'm sure I have a misperception, but my clinical impression of pain management clinics is what people who have been on all kinds of pain medications and they're desperate, they go to as a last resort wanting more pills. What really happens at the pain management clinics and how helpful are they?
Pain management clinics are primarily run by anesthesiologists and a team of doctors, including physiatrists, physical medicine rehabilitation specialists. They usually focus on things like epidural steroid injections, facet rhizotomies, and various pain medication management programs. I have a problem with many pain management programs where they escalate the amount of opioid pain medication, even placing people on very strong narcotics such as methadone for chronic back pain. They're not oriented to taking patients off these medications. There is a very famous pain management program in Miami, the Comprehensive Pain Rehabilitation Program, started by the late Dr. Razumov. He used a holistic approach with exercises, psychological management, and actually detoxing people off of narcotics, and he was highly successful, and his program's still there, and one of the best in the country, in my estimation.
So there's a lot of variation from pain management clinic to pain management clinic, and one of the things you look for is how holistic are they and how much emphasis do they put on pain medication?
how much emphasis they put on taking people off of treatment, no matter what it is, whether it's pain medication or injection.
And while we're on the pain management, on epidurals, you think they're often helpful, but you put a lifetime limit of 6 on them?
It's hard to put a lifetime limit, and nobody knows what the exact limit is, but I see people now that are coming in with 12 epidural steroid injections. Each one costs between $6,000 and $8,000. It's ridiculous. It gets to the point of absurdity where the patient should have been placed on a good exercise program and a weight reduction program and given some common sense advice about their chronic back pain.
And the epidurals are where the steroids are injected directly into the spine, if people aren't familiar with them. You say some of the sensory stimulation methods work pretty well?
Yes, light touch methods. I put acupuncture in that category. They help an unaccustomed level of activity, and you go to bed and your back is aching. After Wilma cleaning up the yard, Wilma was the hurricane, if you don't remember, my back was aching pretty badly. My wife tickled my arm for a little while and just took away the muscle spasm, and I was able to get to sleep. So I invented the term cosquillitas, which in Spanish means little tickles. I actually put that in my book. I wasn't being facetious when I wrote that.
To kind of summarize what we have so far, your most common treatments are getting people to exercise up to their pain level. The little tickling can sometimes help, and we haven't mentioned it yet, but hot and cold is one of the primary things that helps relieve pain.
That's right.
What do you make of the Botox-type treatments that destroy nerves?
That rhizotomy is a whole category of treatment where the nerve to the small joints, the facet joints, is destroyed, and it's either cut with a knife or electrocuted with an electrocautery. And now there's a procedure where Botox is used to destroy the nerve. Botox destroys the nerve for about 6 months, and then it has to be repeated. The evidence-based medicine for facet rhizotomy, for electrically destroying the nerve, shows that it's no better than placebo, and the results actually show that it's worse than placebo for relieving chronic back pain. I put the rhizotomy techniques into almost quack medicine category because there's no studies that show that it works. There's evidence that in some cases it's dangerous, and there is some evidence that it actually is worse than doing nothing.
And that's the beauty of evidence-based medicine, is that it's not just clinical opinion or what Dr. Brown says anymore. It's good data from double-blind, placebo-controlled studies. And often meta-studies that look at groups of well-designed studies. We're talking with Dr. Mark Brown, author of Conquer Back and Neck Pain, Walk It Off. Conquer Back and Neck Pain, Walk It Off is at bookstores, Amazon.com, or if you go to sunriseriverpress.com, that's sunriseriverpress.com, you can read excerpts or even download the book. And at $12, it's a bargain. Dr. Brown practices medicine in Miami, Florida. Matter of fact, if you go on the University of Miami website under Department of Orthopedics, you can find out about his practice. Dr. Brown, I really like this book. It's just a wonderful, practical book that helps you figure out what kind of pain you have. You have marvelous tests for that, what doctors to use, and what works and what doesn't. A very nicely done book.
Thank you, Dr. Bricky.
We'll get back to Dr. Brown in just a minute. Did you ever wonder why some people look, act, and feel more youthful than others? Would you like to know their secret? Well, their secret is they think differently. And if you adopt their mindset, you too can think, feel, look, and be more youthful. Check out antiagingspeaker.com. That's antiagingspeaker.com, antiagingspeaker.com with hyphens in there, to learn how I can help your company or your organization have more youthful, positive employees or members. And when that happens, they're also healthier and more productive. And if you're not sure what website to go to, you can just go to notaging.com, N-O-T-A-G-I-N-G.com, and it's a portal for all of my services. You can connect to my speaking services, to Ageless Lifestyles and the archives of previous shows. You can subscribe to my Freed by Aging newsletter, or go to drbricky.com and learn about my CDs, books, and other information about how to stay as youthful as possible. That portal site again is notaging.com. And now let's get back to Dr. Brown. I want to talk about surgery. You really don't like the minimally invasive surgeries.
If surgery is indicated, it certainly is indicated if you have progressive or severe nerve damage or a progressive severe deformity of some sort in your spine, then educated to do it properly. From 35 years of experience of performing spine surgery, I've come to the conclusion that the surgeon should have proper exposure and careful handling of the soft tissues, such as the nerves, and best done with proper exposure. Now, there are a number of minimally invasive techniques that have been developed, such as through an arthroscopic tube or small incision about an inch long using a microscope. And I think that there are some indications for that in particularly a herniated disc at one level in a young, thin person. But if the surgeon runs into trouble, needs better exposure, they better convert it to a larger incision.
So the appeal of the minimally invasive surgery is the scar's a little smaller, maybe the healing's a little faster, but the doctor doesn't have as much control over this very delicate operation.
That's right, Dr. Bricky, but there's been a study looking at microdiscectomy versus standard discectomy, and patients seem to get out of the hospital at the same time. They go back to work at the same time, and they take the same amount of pain medication. So there doesn't seem to be much more advantage. There is, with all the microsurgical techniques, the surgeon says in the report, there's a learning curve, which is a euphemism to...
Guinea pig?
that it takes a while to not have complications from it.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other surgeries that people ought to get a second, third, or even fourth opinion if their doctor recommends it?
I think that if a patient, and I see this all the time, patients who have a herniated disc on their MRI scan, and they're able to get around, and they actually feel like they're getting better, their leg pain is improving with time, and they're told that if they don't have an operation, they'll become paralyzed. I think that patient instinctually knows that they don't really need the operation, and they should go get another opinion.
One of the fascinating things that you talked about was that just because the MRI looks like there's a serious problem, oftentimes there's no pain or problem associated with it, and you don't mess with it. You only do it if there's both the problem and the pain.
Exactly. We have a saying that the physician who treats the x-rays is a shadow boxer, and the physician who treats the patient is a heavyweight.
Gather that the second biggest problem for chronic pain is spinal stenosis?
Very, very common, and it's amazing. Very few people know what it is.
Well, tell us what it is.
As the disc degenerates, and again, that's genetic, it's like a flat tire on a car, and it bulges, and that takes up room in the spinal canal. Normally, the spinal canal is the size of a quarter in diameter. When the spinal canal becomes constricted as a result of disc narrowing and bulging and the changes that occur in the small joints behind the disc, it can become the diameter of a pencil. And that constricts all the nerves going to the legs and bowel and bladder. That's called spinal stenosis. That can also occur in the neck. And when it does in the neck, it constricts the spinal cord. That can lead to real problems.
We've already talked about some of the things that would help prevent it, the exercise and not smoking, that kind of thing. What can you do if you do have spinal stenosis?
In the low back, which is where it's most common, 80% of cases, if the pain causes disability to such as trying to walk, you can't walk more than a block or two, they have to sit or bend over, and it affects the quality of your life. The operation for it is very effective and can give relief. The indication for surgery in the low back is quality of life. If it occurs in the neck and it causes balance problems, surgery is also effective in reversing that and keeping the patient from becoming quite disabled and wheelchair bound.
One of the things particularly women fear is osteoporosis. Could you paint for us the highest risk person for osteoporosis?
The highest risk person for osteoporosis is a woman who has had a sedentary lifestyle, a pack-day smoker for a number of years, postmenopausal, and a small woman. Very high risk for osteoporosis.
And caffeine and alcohol and steroids would aggravate this as well?
Yes, steroids, alcohol use is aggravated also.
If you have a 67-year-old woman that already has osteoporosis, what do you do with her at that point besides try to improve her habits?
There are good medication now called difosphonate, the most famous of which is Fosamax, and then a whole host of medications now that are used for different types of osteoporosis, and they're available to prevent fractures of the spine, the wrist, and the hip.
Has there been evidence-based medicine on Fosamax?
Yes, there's excellent evidence-based medicine on all the diphosphonates. There's level one evidence and long-term use. Your primary care physician and or internist, they're all aware of when and how to use these medications.
What should we know about spinal fusions?
Well, spinal fusion has a bad name. You know, the Wall Street Journal article, there are too many being done, and I certainly agree with that. But the indication for spinal fusion is when you have a progressive and or severe deformity of the spine, such as from curvature of the spine, scoliosis, or slippage of the spine, spondylolisthesis. The deformity is causing fatigue or balance problems or nerve damage. So spinal fusion is used to correct the deformity and hold it, correct it, then bone graft it so the bone graft fuses across the vertebrae and prevents it from becoming worse.
Is this an area of medicine where 20 years ago it wasn't so well done and now it's well done?
I think with the advent of very good metal fixation devices such as screws and rods and hooks and wires, we now have devices that are highly refined and we can correct and maintain the correction of deformity of the spine from any approach from the front or the back or the side. And it's done safely and has really improved the quality of results.
Wonderful. I want to talk about some of the cutting-edge things. We replace hearts and kidneys. Why can't we replace a disc?
There's actually a series of patients who were done in China. It's a small series, less than 9 patients, who had their discs replaced from cadaver discs in the neck. The discs in the neck are small, and they're technically easier to replace than in the low back. The problem is that they work for a while, and they seem to rapidly degenerate and severely degenerate. It's probably because the preservation of live cells in the cadaver discs is not up to par yet. But we're working on that, and I think that that has some promising chances of working in the future.
Why can't we just inject some stem cells into the disc?
That's a big area of research now. Stem cells and actually replacing genetically deficient cells or inserting the missing genes into cells.
Mm-hmm.
Those are promising areas of research also. Since everybody gets degenerated discs, not everybody would be a candidate for it, but there are some people who get a double dose of bad genes from both parents and who develop degenerated discs as early as 10 to 12 years of age. And when you identify those individuals, I think they're going to be the primary people who will be helped by these technologies.
Do you foresee 10, 20 years from now that we'll have our genes read and identify the genes that cause rapid deterioration of our discs and have corrected genes inserted into our system and solve the problem?
I think that that technology will help a very limited small number of people, but I think the vast majority of people need to go back to the old ways before the automobile and the airplane and get back to just using their bodies and exercising.
So the way you see gene therapy is it can correct some extreme problems, but in terms of our discs wearing out before the rest of our body, there's no one or two genes that we can finger that's going to turn that around.
I don't think so. I think it's a multi-gene problem and very complex problem. I think that all this wonderful science that we have has taught us what common sense tells us, that our body was made to be used and we have to get away from the front of our computer at least an hour a day and exercise.
Are there any other big advances you see in the pipeline?
The biggest advance, I guess, is that just the common sense and mundane thing about why it's important to keep your weight down, not smoke, have a lifetime of exercise to prevent the severity and frequency and length of time that you suffer from back pain. There are these things like artificial discs are highly technical, very limited indications for it. I don't think that they'll be used on a widespread basis to help people with back pain.
I've got a suggestion for your office. I don't know what your politics are, but I would put a poster of John Kennedy up there, and sooner or later somebody will ask, well, why John Kennedy, and what would you tell them?
John Kennedy suffered from back pain all his life, and it was attributed to the PT boat accidents that he had during World War II. But actually, he had chronic back pain, and eventually he was treated with steroids and developed what they call Addison syndrome, a very severe side effect from being treated with steroids. He then underwent a spinal fusion and had an infection, spent a year in the hospital getting over this, and he was on a lot of pain medications. A famous physiatrist, woman physiatrist, physical medicine rehabilitation specialist, got him off the pain medication and put him on an exercise program. His father actually built an Olympic-sized swimming pool in the basement of the White House for him. With his swimming exercises, he was able to become the fine president that he was. Did wear a corset all of his life, and he used the famous rocking chair for his back. But I think he's the most famous example of failed back syndrome of having too much treatment.
After he got off the pain medications, did he also get off the steroids?
No, he had to take steroids the rest of his life. His case report is actually in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery that was published a couple years ago.
And he permanently had the problem of Addison's disease. If after his PT boat accidents he had walked it off, there was a reasonable chance that none of this would have happened?
This is Sunday morning quarterbacking, but I would think so. Looking at his case, maybe he should have met the physiatrist early on in his treatment.
I want to go back to spinal stenosis. What's the difference in symptoms that a person would experience between spinal stenosis and, say, a slipped disc, besides being, say, over 50 or over 60?
With a herniated disc, you have toothache-like pain that goes down your leg or your arm, coming from your back, and it's associated with numbness and tingling, a feeling of weakness sometimes. When you're standing up, you can't bend over because it hurts. It makes your pain go from your buttocks down your leg. With a spinal stenosis, you usually don't have any of those symptoms. At rest, what happens is you get an aching pain in your legs when you walk, and then you sit down or lean up against the side of a building, and the pain goes away. But it's peculiar. You can dance, or you can use a shopping cart and shop, or a stationary bicycle, and you don't get those symptoms. So those are the differences between a herniated disc and spinal stenosis.
And your book has very detailed tests that people can take to distinguish these two problems from several other problems. One of the things that's very confusing is which doctor to go to. Besides your primary care doc, there are spinal surgeons and neurosurgeons and orthopedic surgeons and sports medicine and physiatrist and physical medicine and rehabilitation, rheumatologist, acupuncturist. How do you know which doctor to go to or which doctor to start with?
For the acute episode, people frequently will go to the emergency room and see an emergency care physician. That physician's job is to determine whether they have something severe like an aneurysm or a heart attack. And once they determine that it's acute benign attack of back pain, they place the patient on pain medication and muscle relaxants and send them home and tell them to go seek out care. Next most common type of physician is the primary care physician, or they'll go to a chiropractor. And now there are more and more physical medicine rehabilitation specialists who are very well trained in back pain disorders, and or orthopedic surgeons, or sometimes they'll go to a neurosurgeon directly and to a neurologist, and sometimes frequently to a rheumatologist. All these specialists take care of people with back pain.
So I'm still feeling confused. How do you know which one to go to other than the ER and your family doctor?
Your family doctor usually will decide whether, if you have a herniated disc, whether to send you to an orthopedic or neurosurgeon, or if you have more arthritic complaints, to a rheumatologist. Your family doctor will also determine whether you need somebody like a neurologist, whether you have some neurologic problem. So that's the best route to determine when to go to a specialist. What you should avoid doing is going directly to your massage therapist or your physical therapist before you have a specific diagnosis.
Is there anything else you'd like us to know about neck pain, back pain, and how to take good care of ourselves?
One of the best evidence-based medicine studies I saw was performed in Los Angeles firefighters, and they looked at three groups. One were the group that worked out and were real buff and exercised all the time, another group that were in between, and the third group that sat around munching potato chips and watching TV in between fire rescue calls. And they looked at these folks over a three-year period. The ones that were buff and exercised had the fewest attacks of back pain, less severe attacks of back pain, and they got over them quicker. And I think that study was really the one that clinched it for me and how to advise my patients successfully and how to manage their back pain, how to prevent it, and suffer less from it.
I think evidence-based medicine is the perfect way to wrap things up. And again, a lot of what you're talking about is often less is better, and the pills typically cause more problems than they do good. We've been talking with Dr. Mark Brown, author of Conquer Back and Neck Pain, Walk It Off. Conquer Back and Neck Pain, Walk It Off is at bookstores, Amazon, and at sunriseriverpress.com. You can read excerpts of it or download the book. Dr. Brown practices in Miami, Florida. Dr. Brown, you give such wonderfully practical advice. I think this is just a fabulous book, and really appreciate you sharing your expertise with us.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bricky. It's been a pleasure.
Commentary. What can we make of Dr. Brown's advice? I think he gives excellent holistic, common sense, evidence-based advice. We previously saw evidence-based medicine in our interview with Dr. Ellen Zelikoff, who also was a professor and a researcher. 20 years ago, this data was out there, but it was buried in the medical journals, and most people weren't paying much attention to it. Managed care has certainly been a mixed blessing, but one of the things that managed care did was to place a lot of emphasis on evidence-based medicine, saying, we only want to pay for what works and what has good documentation that it works. And in the last 10 years, in the last 5 years in particular, the evidence-based medicine information is becoming increasingly available to the general public, both in books like Dr. Brown's and Dr. Zelikoff's, and on the internet. While evidence-based medicine is the gold standard in medicine, it's not without its flaws. It basically looks at what gets researched and what gets published. So generic medications, generic supplements, things that don't have a lot of profit in them tend not to get researched and not to get publications. While double-blind studies with placebo controls are the ideals, you can't really do placebo heart transplants. Minorities and even often women are often understudied in these studies and may get very different results than what the evidence-based medicine finds for white males. Women are often understudied because of fear of unknown pregnancies, affecting pregnancies, or future pregnancies. And any research study is just a slice in time. For example, Dr. Brown cited a study in which after 4 years, there was no significant difference between those who had had surgery and those who didn't. But if you'd only looked at the first 6 months, often that's all funding is going to pay for, you would have seen a difference. So evidence-based medicine by its nature is imperfect, but it's still the best basis that we have. Ideally, your physician knows the evidence-based research, considers it, and then uses his or her own judgment in deciding what makes the most sense in your particular case. Hopefully, it doesn't become a straitjacket where if a physician varies from it, presumably for a good reason, and things don't turn out ideally, that suddenly you have a lawsuit and physicians practicing defensive medicine. Because of all these considerations, evidence-based medicine is more helpful in some areas of medicine than other areas. In the area of back problems, there's a particularly good and rich literature. The biggest take-homes from Dr. Brown are that too much of any treatment tends to be problematic, that muscle relaxants, pain pills, and steroids typically cause more problems than they're worth, including depression and, like any medication, being hard on your kidneys and on your liver, and sometimes your stomach as well, that the opiate pain medications block your brain's recognition of your own body's endorphins and eventually suppress your body's production of endorphins, ultimately exacerbating the problem. And finally, we have all of these medications contributing to depression, which makes it a more and more vicious circle. With depression, we have a several-prong issue. One is the lifestyle issues that Dr. Brown talked about of getting good nutrition, getting exercise, losing weight if you're overweight, quitting smoking if you're smoking. Another is psychotherapy may well be helpful, and particularly for a problem like back pain and chronic pain, cognitive behavioral therapy would be the treatment of choice, and evidence-based research suggests that cognitive behavioral therapy is effective in lessening depression about 70% of the time. And finally, there's consideration of antidepressant medications. The research suggests that, like cognitive behavioral therapy, it brings improvement in depression in about 70% of the cases. it is most effective when you have physiological signs of depression, such as a change in appetite, either extreme appetite or no appetite, change in sleeping habits, such as sleeping excessively, or insomnia. The insomnia is a little tricky because it may be caused by the severe back pain as opposed to depression. Another indicator for antidepressant medication is an inability to enjoy anything anymore. While cognitive behavioral therapy and antidepressants have about an equal track record in attenuating depression, the antidepressants do have a number of side effects, and sooner or later, hopefully, you'll be getting off the antidepressants, and if there hasn't been structural change in how you think, then you become vulnerable to depression again. Thus, my recommendation is give first consideration to cognitive behavioral therapy, but also use antidepressant medication if you have the physiological signs of depression. Hopefully, the antidepressant medication is a short-term solution to jumpstart you out of the depression with the cognitive behavioral therapy, changing how you're perceiving things, how you're thinking, so that your thinking isn't going to get you back into depression. A couple other observations. I thought it was fascinating the way Dr. Brown described degenerative disc disease as something that is genetically programmed for us, that for humans, it's normal for our discs to wear out before the rest of our bodies. I personally have a lot of concern about the damage that sports can do to our bodies. I look at the Olympic athletes and how many of them have surgery, and I wonder whether we've done some misplaced values with our overemphasis on sports and pushing athletes to their absolute limits. One area we didn't get into is that poor posture can also contribute to back problems. About 30 years ago, I had a lot of back pain and disc problems, even had one of those epidurals. And fortunately, I went to some posture experts, and they taught me some exercises to strengthen and balance muscles, and I haven't had any serious problems in a couple decades. So tweaking your posture can also help with preventing back problems or correcting back problems. Finally, if you're having difficulty getting motivated to do the lifestyle changes that Dr. Brown talked about, picture that poor disc, and it's waving its arms, it's crying, "Help me, help me, help me, help me, I need better nutrition to heal, I need to get rid of these toxins, I need some oxygen, I need some, my body needs to absorb the materials I'm breaking down, please. Please get some exercise so the muscles will pump nutrients into me and I can heal and help you out." Perhaps that image will help. Baby step. I always try to leave you with a little tweak in your behavior or in your thinking that'll help you live longer, healthier, and happier. Well, if you do get back or neck pain, you certainly want to start with a good diagnosis. One good starting point are the very detailed tests that Dr. Brown has in his book that distinguishes the different types of back pain, but you'll probably want to get a doctor's opinion as well. Still, the more you know about back pain and your type of back pain before you go to the doctor, the better that you can communicate what's going on and get better guidance from the doctor. Then you want to consider Dr. Brown's advice, which is typically less is better, and exercise is the key to healing. And often what you need to do is walk it off or exercise it off. And if there are lifestyle issues that are contributing to the problem, such as poor nutrition, smoking, or excesses with caffeine, then it's even more important to address the issues when your body is trying to heal. Emails. I love to get emails. You send them to radio@agelesslifestyles.com. That's radio@ageless, A-G-E-L-E-S-S, lifestyles, lifestyles.com. Most of the emails I received on last week's program about centenarians had to do with, "Mike, how in the world can you afford to live well into your hundreds?" Good question. There is no one formula. 65 years ago, before we had Social Security and when our nation wasn't nearly as affluent as it is now, most centenarians were poor. Today, there are a number of sources that may be contributing to a centenarian's income. One is Social Security. Often they have pensions from jobs that they've had. They may have savings, home equity, and they may have had inheritance. When it comes to pensions and when it comes to savings, oftentimes we're talking about couples who have been pooling their resources and eventually one of them dies and the other inherits the wealth. With people being healthier, people are continuing to work in their 60s and 70s and 80s, even 90s and in their hundreds. Oftentimes, this is part-time work or consulting work, but nevertheless, it brings in income. It continues to contribute to pension plans, and it makes it much more feasible to have a comfortable lifestyle well into your hundreds. Also, keep in mind that some of these people are living with family, so they're not having to make mortgage payments and utility payments. In the show in which we interviewed John Erickson, we saw how they could choose to live in a retirement community in which the cost wouldn't be any more than the cost of living for them supporting themselves in their own house that's probably already paid for. Finally, if you look at who lives to 100, they tend to be more high-energy, active, positive people, and consequently, I would expect them to tend to be more successful in their jobs and earn more money in their jobs. This is Dr. Michael Bricky with Ageless Lifestyles Radio on webtalkradio.net. All of the previous programs are archived on agelesslifestyles.com. That's agelesslifestyles.com. agelesslifestyles.com, where you can see a synopsis of the program, a picture of the guest, and download the MP3. If you're not sure what website to go to, you can just go to notaging.com, notaging.com. And notaging.com is a portal that will direct you to whatever website you need, for example, to sign up for the Defy Aging newsletter, to learn about my speaking services, to get the archived versions of previous shows, or to learn about my books, CDs, and other information about how to defy aging. This is Dr. Michael Bricky, thanking you for joining us on our quest to live longer, healthier, and happier.